You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's Friday Morning GM with my co-host, Voss Larikos. Voss, how you doing?
Good to be with you, Ken. Very interesting times at the castle here. We had the midweek trade, but I'm happy to break it all down with you in this tough season.
Yeah, lots to go on. And you've made the point, I think it's right on the money, that in a season like this, some of the reviews, the offense and defense, they take kind of a back seat in a lot of people's minds to looking at the GM show here and what the Ravens are going to do about it going forward, you know, what they might do with draft capital they obtain, whether they're out there sellers, for instance, at the trade deadline, all of that. And we encourage people not only to listen to the show, and thanks for doing so, but also to provide your questions. We've got an unbelievable number of questions today. They're good, and we're not able to get to all of them, but we're going to get to what we can, and we appreciate you. Hashtag film study mailbag when you want to hit that. If you want to tack an extra FMGM right after it, that's great, or just tag Voss as well, and then I'll know for sure that you intend for that to be on Friday Morning GM.
Looking forward to it. Great questions all around.
Looking forward to the Rams game on Sunday. I'm still hopeful the Ravens could bail themselves out with a win here. It's not a super likely event, but it is one that hopefully they can get them back into contention with a win. There's certainly a coaching job's in jeopardy if the game is not won, particularly if the result is similar to the Texans game, for example, a really one-sided defeat, which would be the third in a row. It's incredible. You know, they went 4 years of Lamar starting games without any such games, you know, and then they've had two in a row now, and they're staring right down the barrel of a third two-score defeat here against the Rams.
Yeah, you could even say three in a row. I know that they made that Lions game close at the end, but it's been a tough start, no question about it. The Rams are currently 7.5 point, or I guess I should say the Ravens are 7.5 point home dogs. So that gives a little bit of an indication of where the bookmakers believe this line should lie. The Ravens are getting a little bit healthier, which we'll come back to in a later segment. But coaching jobs in jeopardy. I think obviously Zach Orr's been on the hot seat. Some folks have nitpicked his scheme. I'm not necessarily qualified to do so, but 26th in DVOA on defense, that speaks for itself. It's been a tough start as far as the competition they're faced, but DVOA incorporates that and, you know, adjust for level of competition. 26 is a far cry from where we thought this team would be entering the season, top three, top five type team.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And injuries have played an enormous, enormous role in that. But it's actually, I'm a little surprised they're as high as 26th under DVOA, even with adjustments, that they'd be that high. But it's a team that there is not an easy fix on defense. I agree with you about the scheme thing. And I studied the defense very closely in packages and alignments and whatnot. I did have one objection to what Orr did this last week, but Orr is really limited in terms of options. And the big one I had this last week is they trotted out 14 times. The Texans put Blake Fisher on the field as a sixth offensive lineman. Mm-hmm. On six of those occasions, Orr responded with the nickel defense. I'm hoping, by the way, I think Orr is at the podium today, almost as we speak, as we record this.
Yes.
I'm hoping that Jonah Schaefer or one of the other folks will ask him that question and just say, you know, hey, we noticed you know, you went light basically versus their heavy formations. It's the first really sign I've seen that, hey, you know, you can look at the results and say they're not working out, but you know, there's a lot of players out of position and it's really hard to blame Orr directly for that. But that's the first really bad scheme thing I've seen. The other thing that happened on Sunday was a lack of willingness to dip into schematic deception for the pass rush, even though that was the thing that was actually fairly successful in very limited trials. So yes. I'm wondering, you know, is that something that that we should be expecting more of this week?
You know, I think soft coverage can be questioned from the outside mm-hmm. observer's eye. But one thing I think maybe, and this probably falls on Eric DaCosta and maybe John Harbaugh more than Zach Gore, was the decision not to acquire a competent third safety until the sixth week of the season. This is something we identified all the way back in August.
True.
Ardarius Washington hurt his, you know, he tore his Achilles in May. They had plenty of time. And we all said we need Kyle Hamilton to be that chess piece, and they didn't give him the pieces to allow that to happen. So, you know, I'm not sure how much of that Zach Gore's fault. That could fall on the higher-ups.
Yeah, that actually, I would say that's maybe equally a Harbaugh and DaCosta thing, maybe even a little bit more a DaCosta thing, because DaCosta, you know, is supposed to be able to see the big picture and make some of those decisions. That's a big problem. You're right, and we have known for a long time, and it was an unaddressed problem. And in some ways, I think it's a worse problem than what's happened with the offensive line, which I honestly don't believe is that terrible. You know, scoring every block, there's a whole lot of people whining about it, but frankly, they're a middle-of-the-league offensive line, and they're paid like a middle-of-the-league offensive line, and they're that way without their $20 million left tackle. I just don't see that as the big failure. Now, the injuries on the defensive line have been absolutely gut punch after gut punch in terms of who they've lost there and not having enough healthy bodies to accomplish much of anything. And then, you know, the potential for a career-ending injury for Nnamdi Matabike, whether or not that's true, you know, I won't will it to be either way, but I'm sure that, you know, it's not what the Ravens planned for, obviously, you know, on the second year of his extension for this to happen.
Oh, of course. And the deficiencies, the lack of maybe impact depth on the defensive line is a fair critique. I know a lot of folks were pining for an early pick on the defensive line, or self included. Mm-hmm. I don't think the lack of a backup left tackle and you only got Joe Noteboom, I don't think that's a fair critique. There's not a bevy of, you know, capable backup left tackles just floating around out there. I think DaCosta made a good addition there, even though he didn't play too well this last week.
Yeah, I agree too. I think Noteboom was a reasonable choice as a backup. And then they also went fairly aggressively after Carson Vinson at a time when they finally did have a chance based on their position and the contracts of Rosengarten and Stanley to take a chance on a developmental left tackle. And if that pays off, that's really going to pay off for the Ravens. I mean, they'll essentially have you know, a talent that you would normally have to draft in the first or second round that they'll have gotten in round four. They'll only have 2 years of him more than likely, but it could really pay off for them.
Oh, for sure. Let's weave in a mailbag question from Minion Hunter here. If the Ravens defense hasn't looked good well since McDonald left, have the Ravens exhausted the promotion from within options and need to look outside for the next Ravens DC? And then he says Weaver's D was just gashed in Miami. Anthony Weaver.
So the two guys they had were Weaver and the guy who went to Tennessee, whose name
Denard
is
Wilson.
Denard Wilson. Yeah. So they were the two who also could have been defensive coordinators. It is the nature of good teams. You constantly are losing your good young coaches, whether they're coordinators or they're even lower down, you lose them. And Weaver gave every indication of being a fine leader when he was here. It was very clear he was headed for bigger things in terms of a coordinator or head coach role. Really a shame they lost him for multiple reasons. For that, for the Rooney Rule effect and whatnot, they could have had a couple third round picks if they'd have promoted him to defensive coordinator and then he left for a head coaching role. It's just a lot of reasons why that was sad. But you know, you're just not going to keep a McDonald from leaving. That's the truth of the matter. And you know, the Ravens are built on a CEO head coaching scheme. It did not work at all to have Brian Billick be an oversight of offensive coordination when he was here. That wasn't the strength of the team. The strength of the team was defense.
Yeah, and he pivoted from his priors.
But also, I know there have been people who've made the point that the Ravens have not been a get a superstar coach on one side of the ball and make him your head coach and give up on the CEO component of that. And I actually think that runs counter to who Bisciotti is as a human being. He's been a management consulting and a guy who's made his money in hiring and really understanding how organizations fit together well. I think he wants that structure.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I do have some questions on how the silos work, and maybe we could save that for, you know, maybe the bye week, or, you know, because if John Harbaugh has the silo of coaching and he has complete control, it doesn't seem like DaCosta has complete control over the roster and the players, because Harbaugh also has influence there, whether he's pining for Rasheen Ali to be on the 53 or handpicking certain draft picks. So maybe there's a better way to do it, but we can dive into that. Just taking it back to Minion Hunter's question here, I would look for the next defensive coordinator, assuming that there's not an in-house replacement, to come from that McDonald tree and that Jesse Minter tree. So if you're looking this offseason, look at who the Chargers and Seahawks have as far as up-and-coming coaches. I do think that scheme is can be very effective against modern offenses.
Yeah, very high probability of that, I'd say. You know, meaning not necessarily 50%, but the plurality likelihood is probably that they reach into one of those two staffs and get their guy. But there's, to me, this is a no stone left unturned. When you're the Baltimore Ravens, you should have a lot of pull in terms of whoever you want to bring in as a coach. And I think they have shown that Harbaugh has that kind of pull in terms of finding people that have quickly moved on to higher roles. But they really should have this pull if they want to hire a guy who's 52 and has a great track record of being a defensive coordinator and doesn't really want to be a head coach, or he does. Either way, I think the entire spectrum of potential candidates should look at the Baltimore job and say, this is one of the best ones that's out there.
Yes, I agree with that. For sure. They treat the coaches great, and they put them in positions to succeed. So why wouldn't you want to coach here, especially with Lamar Jackson on the contract?
Now, we got interesting news on the injury front. Obviously, this last week they played without their sixth highest paid players against the Texans: Jackson, Smith, Hamilton, Humphrey, Stanley, and Madubuike. I believe those are sixth highest by AAV, I believe, the way that's done, because Hamilton is not making that money really yet. I mean, he did get a signing bonus, but he's not making that money yet on an annual basis. Ricard had not practiced in weeks, and we thought this was a possibility that they should have IR'd him. And instead of trying to play through an NFL game with seven defensive backs active, which is just one of the riskiest things I've ever seen.
Oh, for sure. There's no question. I was shocked that they went that route. You can look back upon cutdown day and week one. And if Ricard went on IR at that point, maybe the Ravens keep Jalen Armour Davis. And maybe once Jair Alexander is getting smoked in the fourth quarter, Jalen Armour Davis comes in and makes a play. It's a sliding doors moment potentially, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get to the injury report from Thursday. And this is a participation report, so we don't know in what capacity the calf injured players both returned: Marlon Humphrey and Patrick Ricard. I haven't seen Ricard out there on the field in a long time. The three players that are still out are the hamstring variety: Lamar Jackson, Roquan Smith, and Chidobe Awuzie. If Marlon can go this week, that would certainly benefit the Ravens defense. Ricard apparently is not expected to play this week. Harbaugh intimated that Chicago is their target date after the bye.
Yeah. And so he's limited today though. And with Marlon, I'm a little more optimistic. I don't know where you're on this, but it has been a common thing in the past that players will be none limited full in 3 days of practice. It is a potential path to for him playing on Sunday.
Yeah, and he's played through injuries before. He's a tough guy for sure. I guess hamstrings, one where you can re-aggravate it maybe more than a calf. I'm not a doctor, but it seems that they're being a little more cautious with the hamstrings, and I don't blame them. But certainly good to see Humphrey back on the field. The other addition to the injury report on Thursday was Ben Cleveland with an undisclosed absence. Could be a funeral, or could be who knows what it could be, or it could be an injury. So that may limit their options if they were intending to shake up the O-line, but we'll see what it looks like on Friday.
Okay. Still a limitation in terms of the number of healthy cornerbacks they have. If Humphrey is back, obviously a lot of the parking lot puzzle is fixed in terms of having enough total, quote unquote, healthy bodies. But I still feel like Marquise Robinson on the practice squad is sitting there and like a fresh piece of meat for the Wolves right now.
Yeah. I probably would have activated him last week, but they just don't want to put any of these players on IR. The one I'm really looking at closely on Friday will be Ronnie Stanley. Is he full or is he limited? You know, because mm-hmm. that's the one that could potentially have a major impact. He looked pretty rough in the videos we saw last week, did not give it a go after trying against KC and quickly being shut down. So I think we have a question that from Abbas that ties into that question a little bit. Yeah, here we go. So would you be in favor? This is from Abbas Bokari. Would you be in favor of Corey Bullock getting more opportunities on the offensive line?
I mean, my answer would be yes, generally speaking. The question is where. So if the Ravens are losing, in the process of losing another game, I don't have any problem on pulling Linderbaum, getting Bullock in there, and seeing what you got for 2026, because that's really where we'd be. Putting Bullock at guard, replacing either Fa'alele or Voorhees. Voorhees needs a lot of live fire, so I wouldn't pull Voorhees for him. Would I pull Fa'alele at some point? I could see a rotation if you need to get him some snaps that way. I don't think Fa'alele deserves to be pulled from the lineup. I think he's honestly played too well for that. But I know a lot of people disagree with me, but in terms of how I weight the things that are truly important as an offensive lineman, I think Fa'alele has played pretty well. I want to say, well enough to not get pulled. Anyway, let's put it that way.
Well, let's get a little outside influence for a little objectivity, because sure. I know you score differently than PFF, but they mm-hmm. score as well, and it's a data point at least. Daniel Fa'alele, according to PFF, is the 38th graded offensive guard in the NFL this season. So he's an average player. He's the middle of the pack. Voorhees, on the other hand, is 59th. So if I was Warhop or Harbaugh, I would say maybe some type of platoon or rotation between Voorhees and Bullock. You know, you're trying to create a spark here. If there's, Kyle Van Noy said it, sometimes it just takes one play and everything can kind of, the whole mojo and the momentum can turn around. I don't know. Warhop doesn't like rotations, but they've done it before. And I don't think Voorhees has done enough to say he earned every single snap in a game.
Well, I think that's fair. And he had a bad game after two good ones. I think he earned a little bit of leash, but you're right. He didn't have a good game this last week, certainly. And so from a how well are they playing standpoint, Voorhees would be the guy in theory. From a getting to see Bullock at the position he would be playing in 2026, I think it's Linderbaum.
Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. But, even if he can, if he can connect on a pool or something like that. Anyway, should we move on to Emory Jones?
Yeah, sure. Obviously an interesting situation. He has to be added to the roster by 10/22. It's approximately that. I think he practiced on Tuesday, and it's usually midweek they do the ramp up so that they can then get a midweek activation. It could be three full games that he misses during that period. It'd be the first game after 10/22 is the one he would play. We have no idea what he's going to look like. We have no idea if he's going to be ready for even rotational play or for even, I guess he'll probably be ready to do a mop-up game if he needed to. Mm-hmm. But the guy's missed all of OTAs, all of camp. He's just starting to practice with the team for the first time ever. Expecting him to be the savior is probably unreasonable.
Yeah. Well, he changed the positions too, right? I mean, I don't think he's going to be a tackle when he's right. Potentially gets some playing time. But he has been in the facility all summer and through the fall, and so hopefully he's picked up some knowledge there. There's no replacement for live reps. We all know that. We'll see what comes. We'll hope for the best. We'll hope for the best there, third-round pick. But let's hope he turns into something. Moving on to the practice squad, a very interesting addition, and somebody that I had mentioned last week I did not think was a fit for this organization. Chauncey Gardner-Johnson or CJ Gardner-Johnson. I remember when he still went by Chauncey Gardner when he was playing at the University of Florida. He seems like one of the real mercurial malcontents of the league. I was surprised that the Eagles let him go, because he is, when he's on the field and has his head in the right place, he's a bona fide playmaker. And then he was traded to Houston. and Houston released him after a couple weeks. Now, they have a pretty stacked secondary, but pretty unusual to have a player of that caliber released. Interesting addition. I think he could fill in as a, in the slot or as a deep safety potentially, but I do expect some – I know some think he's going to be activated this week. I expect some sort of ramp up.
Yeah, I don't think there's actually a way to get him activated this week easily, and we could you'd probably talk about that. But the Ravens have both of their elevations effectively accounted for between Huntley and a defensive lineman. So they don't have – I mean, they just don't have the healthy bodies to not activate Huntley and Okoye. They could bring somebody up to the 53, but that would require them to IR somebody or release somebody, and I just don't think they're willing to do it. If there was a player, you know, the player you'd probably release for him is Lowry. And then you try and re-sign Lowry to your practice squad, I think.
I think Mitchell Payton's time on the 53 may have run its course. He is not performing very well, and the heavy sets are not working. And John Harbaugh made mention that everybody knows that Keaton Mitchell's getting the ball if he comes in. Well, it seems like everybody knows when Derrick Henry's getting the ball because of the way they've divided up the splits, and he's just not gaining – any push, and they're hitting him in the backfield almost every time when they go heavy. So Mitchell Payton might be, especially with Ricard now, you know, practicing at least on the field, and you have three other tight ends, and can Kolar do some of that and can likely do, you know, help out with the chip blocks or Andrews. The other one, and it's probably a pipe dream because we know how stubborn John Harbaugh is, but Rasheen Ali, you know, they're I think fit close to the bottom, in kickoff coverage. They're allowing, you know, the fifth most or something like that, last I saw. At what point does that value become a detriment?
I'm with you. Getting back to Gardner Johnson for a second, and he does have a fairly remarkable career as a coverage player. Prior to this year, he never allowed as high as an 80 or 90 opposing passer rating in a season. And his career opposing passer rating is 82.7, even including some bad snaps this year. Had six picks last year for the Eagles. And then you look at that and you say, that's pretty darn good. And you see he's on his fifth team. Yeah. And you really, and he's had two tours with Philadelphia among those five teams. So 3 years at New Orleans, one at Philadelphia, Detroit, Philadelphia, Houston, Baltimore now. It does not speak to a guy who really wants to play by a set of rules that's laid out by management.
Yeah, you know, sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Ed Reed was a mercurial player. The juice was definitely worth the squeeze. Chauncey Gardner, Gardner Johnson, CJ Gardner Johnson, maybe not so much. This does dovetail into a question from, let's see here, Brendan Way. Let me see if I can locate that.
Yeah, I've got it down here at the bottom here if you want
go
me
ahead.
To.
Go ahead. I just lost
so,
it.
So Brendan Way, the moves for Gardner Johnson and Gilman feel similar to the 2019 midseason signings of ILBs, Bynes, and Fort. Has there been any indication that the safety play is the or a major cause for lapses in the defense? I think there has been because the coverage from the linebackers has been so bad. Whenever you see that, safeties may be playing a part in that. They've obviously given up a fair number of plays that are deep, but they're also getting beat in the run. So it's kind of hard to just pull the one thing that's wrong with the Ravens defense as poorly as they played. Brendan continues to say, to me, these moves feel like a way to stabilize the backfield, which will allow Hamilton to move to the middle of the field and assist with our linebacker woes. And if that's the case, why is the defensive scheme, so difficult for safeties?
Well, we said a long time ago, I think this is actually on a previous podcast you should do with Yuri, but you build the defense from back to front. You scheme it from front to back. And it doesn't seem like the scheme on the front is generating enough pressure to put the safeties in position. There's a lot of pressure on them. There's a lot of pressure. I do think it's a valid point. You know, you have Marcus Williams, who had a track record of, you know, Pro Bowl play. You had Eddie Jackson, who had a track record of Pro Bowl plays all along in the tooth. They failed. You put Lowry in this week. He looked tough. I mean, I do think it's a legitimate question that, you know, is scheme too hard on the safeties? And then, you know, they were forced to put Hamilton back there to stabilize it. I think it's a fair question. But I don't know if Aloe Gilman is the solution. I didn't catch your full instant reaction pod, but his advanced metrics, yards per target and missed tackles, were both pretty tough.
Yeah, missed tackles are a little high, and yards per target has not been his real strength as a player his entire career. But he's been better the last couple of years. He's been better, but it's a significant concern, and hopefully some of the connection between Gilman and Hamilton, I hope, still carries over even with Hamilton moving up front. They'll still be together on the back end in base coverage schemes, which probably means they're never in a kind of a Tampa 2 look in a base scheme, because that'd be very unusual that you don't go to a post with the base in. But, you know, I'm also glad to see that they acquire two safeties on one day, you know, with Gardner Johnson and Alohi Gilman, and it's not an injury concern. That doesn't mean it's not a play concern. So yeah. Lowry gave up two touchdowns in this last game. Both of them were kind of not being in the right place and not being in the right place, I guess, is the way I put it. They weren't long touchdowns, but they were both touchdowns. And I was very high on Lowry coming into the season. I really loved what he did in the preseason. I thought he looked very good. He just has not shown the kind of reading skills during the regular season that he did then. He was just out of position too much in this game. And the eye candy is moving right by him. The number 14 who caught the touchdown pass, I'm forgetting his name, but he ran right by his face. And he had to know that was his coverage responsibility if he came out. He had to be the widest of the wide. And
Hutchinson, I believe, right? Xavier Hutchinson.
Xavier Hutchinson is number 19. Number 14 is the other guy that I'm talking about. He did. I think he gave up a touchdown to Hutchinson also. But
okay. I mean, he's an undrafted rookie. You know, he's an undrafted rookie. At the end of the day, it's a tall task, and he's trying to communicate with another undrafted rookie in the slot. And they're, you know, it's when you hit some critical mass of injuries, it is what it is. But anyway, getting back to the practice squad, Josh Tupu was released, which I think was a good decision there. And JT Gray, the special teams ace, has still not been, on the practice field. The last we heard, he was injured. I don't know how many more roster spots they can really afford for special teams. But it's, in the terms of elevations, I definitely think Okoye would be a prime candidate. I thought Okoye, as well as Trenton Simpson, if you're looking for bright spots from young players, showed a little bit of something against Houston.
A little something. I mean, Okoye still is a guy who's not going to fix the run game on his own, because he doesn't really set his feet in a way that helps him absorb double teams. But they did some things in this game that I kind of liked, and part of it might have been trying to get him off of double teams, was to get him as a three tech instead of as a one tech. And yeah. So they had a fair number of plays where he and Jenkins were on the field together. Also Jenkins and Jones, by the way, in this. I really love seeing Travis Jones playing some three tech in this game. But they it's not like Orr is not trying anything with the personnel he's got. He's trying to build a skyscraper out of, you know, Lincoln Logs here. It doesn't have very much to work with here.
That's a good analogy. I like that one.
Yeah.
Marquise Robinson, I guess his potential elevation would be pending Humphrey and or Awuzie. It doesn't look like Awuzie is going to go, but probably pending Humphrey's availability. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not.
I think Marquise Robinson will have to be activated at the 53 at some point. I think he's too valuable a safety or a corner, rather. He had a really good preseason, and he's one of the guys who I think would be on a short list for a lot of teams when they have an injury to snag and kind of playing a game of chicken with the other teams in the league. And I know you don't want to lose, you know, a valuable special teams player, maybe a Jay Higgins or something. I'm not Marquise Robinson, I would think, has significantly more, maybe not, attractiveness to other teams in the league. If you need a starting corner, Marquise Robinson's your guy. If you want a big on special teams, then Jay Higgins is your guy. I don't think anybody's saying that Jay Higgins is ready to play starting linebacker though yet.
No, but I'd like to see him get in the rotation. You know, Buchanan is a fourth round pick again, so you can't be too tough on him, but he's had his struggles at times, certainly in coverage. Again, I'd come back to the offensive side of the ball. Kevin, you have 9 roster spots tied up in running backs, fullbacks, and tight ends. That's too many. You got to, if you're looking to release somebody, Mitchell Payton or Ali would be the guy for me if you really need to make space. Let's move on to the defensive line. Unless you have a thought on that. So Travis Jones played pretty well, I thought. You know, he's not 100%, but he's toughing it out. And these Peebles was not given too much of opportunity. Jenkins played a large share of snaps, really picked that up. Brent Urban had probably his best game in the last year and a half or so, or half a year. And, you know.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
I love my morning coffee, but sometimes the crash hits harder than the caffeine. That's when I switch to Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee infused with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics, giving me smooth, focused energy that actually lasts. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Enter for a chance to win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's policygenius.com.
I don't know if you think they need more on the defensive line. Probably Ange Love's question speaks to that.
Okay, well, let's start with Jenkins, because I think he had one of his worst games. He had a bunch of missed tackles, including one early on where he's in the backfield, looked like he down for about a 4 or 5 yard loss and let him get away. And then he ended up running for some significant gain. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Would you categorize that as one of those good missed tackles? Not good, but acceptable? Okay.
No.
Because no one else was close enough to do the cleanup.
He's got to do something to retract the runner for me to even classify it up from the very bottom. So if he just misses in the backfield and there's no rerouting of that runner in any way, then no, it's not a good missed tackle.
No, that makes sense.
It might not be the worst missed tackle, because if you're the last line of defense and you miss that tackle and guy runs 20 more yards for a touchdown, that could be worse, but this was bad. Yeah.
No, it makes sense. Yeah.
Angelov's question says, hi, Ken and Voss, regarding the D-line, how high of a pick should the Ravens be willing to part with? I assume he means this year and during before the trade deadline and not in next year's draft, because those two questions are very different, I think. Given the current record, we might be picking high. Also, roster for next year should be a strong consideration, especially if Mads can't come back. Great point that Matabike's absence means the Ravens are going to be in search of defensive line in the draft next year. I don't like Band-Aid solutions right now for this team. Where are you on that, Voss? Because you're normally, you'd be more one of the most Band-Aid-y of the Band-Aids.
No, I'm anti-Band-Aid, Ken. I think one of maybe the worst strategic mistake the team ever did was not rebuilding after 2015 and trying to put it together with Band-Aids after Flacco had a negative interception touchdown and he was hurt and they were shorthanded no matter what they did. And maybe they would have had a lot more cap space during Lamar's rookie contract if they didn't do that. So I was going to use the word Band-Aid in my response and say, I don't want to use an early pick for a Band-Aid, especially when right now they're projected to have the number three pick. I definitely don't expect them to finish there this year. But if you're looking at a top 12 pick, maybe if things go south, you don't want to spend that. I would say a fourth round pick. And I don't think any of these Dexter Lawrence, Jeffrey Simmons, Quinnen Williams, pie in the sky, I think they're a pipe dream. First of all those guys are under big money contracts for the next 2 years at least. Second of all, why would the rebuilding team want to trade that? Those are the cornerstone players that they're looking to grab, not trade away for a mid-round pick. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Well, and if they did want to unload the contract, they're going to want to get paid in draft capital for any cap they eat for the Ravens, which would be a possibility. Yeah. But in a lot of cases, it just means the player can't be traded, not practically under any kind of cap constraints. And that's why all the notions that the Ravens are going to somehow trade Roquan right now, well, A, Roquan's injured and nobody would want him. Okay.
Yeah.
B, Roquan has the kind of bloated contract the Ravens can't possibly absorb with their current cap space. They've got about $14 million right now, but they can't absorb what it would take to accelerate Roquan to the finish line right now. They could after the season, they can, but not now.
Well, the one thing, so when they restructured Roquan, simple restructure, I said, well, if they don't use the cap space, then it'll just happen next year. No harm, no foul. But then you trade Matabike and pick up $7 million. You're like, well, you could have maybe saved his salary for the second half of this year. That's neither here nor there. But some of the decisions, giving Derrick Henry an extension 2 more years when he was already under contract for 1 year and doubling his APY, they did the same exact thing for Rashad Bateman this offseason. They had him under contract for 2 more years. They doubled his APY, went from 6.4 to 12.2. And these players can't hold out. The CBA prevents them from doing that. So I think they need to be a little bit more cautious with pushing this money out.
I am in the case of the Bateman contract, I think it was way below market for wide receivers. And Bateman's coming off a good year. I didn't really have a problem with the pricing on it. Hasn't really worked out, honestly, but I didn't have a problem with it. The other contract you mentioned was the
Derrick Henry.
The Derrick Henry contract. Yeah, that's much more of a question in terms of did it really make sense?
25 million guaranteed. They tacked on 25 million guaranteed for a 31-year-old running back. I don't think that was a good decision.
He's not any 31-year-old running back, but he is Nolan Ryan so far in terms of his ability to keep himself conditioned and whatnot. But we really have noticed it was Lamar driving Henry and not Henry driving Lamar from these last few weeks of this year. It should be very clear that Henry really requires the Lamar misdirection to be effective.
Yep. Dependent. I think we're through the run sheet if you want to hit some of these mailbag questions, Ken.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. What have we not said? Okay. So Drew Williams says, Ken, seeing some trade suggestions for Andrews, I think it's 100% makes sense to trade and get some value, but a sixth round pick? ? Plenty of teams can use his talent if we are eating his $17 million cap or most of it. Doesn't that drive up the value for a higher pick? I think, I don't know if a sixth is the right number or not. There's about $7 million I think he has under current salary this year, and the Ravens could save $4 million, $5 million, that range in terms of not paying his salary the rest of the year if they traded him. On the other hand, in terms of what he's worth as a comp pick, I'm not sure it's a whole lot You know, might they get a sixth round comp pick in 2027, possibly. And then you can think that his value maybe for the rest of the year is something. Honestly, I'm sad to say, I think a six is about right. And maybe it puts them in a position where they make the commitment to Isaiah Likely and move on.
Yeah. So his base, I'm looking at it here, pulled it up, $7 million base salary. So mm-hmm. they'd save about half of that. That to me would be where the value is, you know, accumulate cap space. They accumulated cap space with the OA trade. They accumulated cap space with the Roquan restructure. To me, if the season goes sideways, you know, they're better off building up a war chest of assets to attack the offseason with a lot of ammunition.
I wouldn't be particularly excited about the extra sixth round pick. They got a bunch of fifths in this draft, and I hope they can make the best of those picks. But an extra sixth, it just doesn't have a tremendous amount of value. I know some of the flatter schemes will tell you that that pick is, you know, it's not that much less valuable than a fourth round pick kind of thing. I don't believe that. And if you look at the sixth round, I don't think we've seen that kind of value, particularly when you, this is important, when you deduct what is the replacement level from the kind of AV values that are out there on Pro Football Reference. Most teams don't do that, and it inflates the value of later round picks. Most methods don't.
Yeah, I mean, sixth, seventh round, even the fifth round, a lot of picks lately are going to special teamers. They're not going to offensive, defensive players. So, I guess we have a question from John here, and I'll address this one to you, Ken, because he's aiming his arrow at you. Last episode, you went off about what a disaster a Parsons deal would have been given our injuries, without considering that we may have been 3-1 or better going into this stretch. Not great analysis.
Okay, so John, everybody's entitled to their opinion. And one of the things on Twitter that's just my basic philosophy of life is, if you're addressing a thing like that and you don't ask me a question directly, and he didn't, he just had an opinion on it, that's fine. I'm not going to respond to it. There are people who get defensive about that. They generally tend to be very weak and not very secure in who they are. John, I'd ask a question right back to you. Do you really believe that having Micah Parsons on this team would make the Ravens still a contender right this moment if they had him? I think the injuries, you know, the gambling public still believes they're a contender anyway, but I it's very hard for me to believe that it would have really drastically changed their record. I don't think in any way it turns around either of the last two games. Might they have won the Buffalo game with Parsons? I don't know, but the cost of Parsons was incredibly high. It was debilitating to the franchise in terms of draft picks plus an enormous bloated contract that you'd have to put on the books. And it would have been an all-in move. I mean, literally, you're in the World Series of Poker. Getting Parsons is the equivalent of pushing every chip you've got into the pot. Yeah. And it can work for some teams under some circumstances, and it might work for the Packers this year. I don't think it was a particularly savvy move.
Yeah, I don't have much to add there. I'll move on to Saeed Tabatabai question.
The Dr. OA Syed, trade, I think it is.
Yes, Dr. Syed, pardon me. The OA trade has freed up some significant cap room. Do you think it's a foregone conclusion the Ravens will make some more signings this year and try to salvage this season, given how wide open the AFC is, or sit tight on the money for extensions next year?
I want to give you a chance to respond to this, but I'll just say I think they have a bunch of bloat in the Lamar Jackson contract, and this is actually kind of a prophylactic for the possibility they can't get him extended in a timely fashion for these next 2 years. But they have a lot of money in Lamar Jackson, and they have to get him restructured and extended in order to do a lot of the other signings they want to make. And otherwise, they need that $14 million to address part of the difference between, I think it's 45 this year and 72 next year.
Yeah, Lamar has him over the barrel. He cannot be franchise tagged, and they can't force him to restructure. And last time, he essentially forced them to overpay for Odell Beckham. So, you know, who's to say Lamar's not going to say, I'll restructure, but I get to pick my offensive coordinator or something of the sort. As far as a foregone conclusion, you know, I won't put anything past this organization. I wouldn't be shocked if they kept Zach Orr through 17 games with the 32nd defense. They're very, resolute in their continuity. And they want to contend every season. That's their primary goal. Sometimes that's a competing goal with trying to win a Super Bowl, and it's hard to demonstrate that. But this trade deadline actually is maybe an example of where trying to contend this season could hinder their future attempts to win a Super Bowl. So, you know, unless you see some big time turnaround, I personally would rather reserve these assets for the future. That's my personal take.
Yeah, that's mine as well. And, you know, I hope that if they go the selling route, that they aggressively do it. I think that they have some, they're in a rare position for a contending team that they have a lot of players that are cheap as hell that other teams would really covet. And Linderbaum, likely Travis Jones, and Owe was a fourth who wasn't terribly expensive. He could be fit under a lot of caps. That you know, make a lot of sense for other teams. Who am I forgetting? I mean, Kohler could be in the group. Andrews is in the group because he only has $7 million of contract value. I mean, they've got players who can be moved.
How about Hopkins? I think Hopkins might have some value. Well, he's played this year, you know. And then, you know, to Doctor's point here, the AFC is wide open. Well, maybe that it can help you instead of bidding more. One team makes a move, then there's a little bit of an arms race in the AFC potentially. I don't know. You know, you need to see a couple more weeks play out before that, but it could potentially behoove the Ravens to be sellers this year.
Now, let's just play a devil's advocate position here for the Ravens to be buyers still, even right now. Do you think the Ravens, in terms of trading a pick that's not in a compensation round, because usually when you trade a pick in a compensatory round where there might be a compensatory pick involved, it's typically a floater and you get a pick at the end of the round. But let's say they were to trade a third round pick this year where they're not getting any, nobody's returning a third from the guys they lost last year. So let's say they traded that pick. Do you think there's another team that says, this year, you know, that's not pick number 85, like it might be in a typical Ravens season. That could be pick number 74, which has, you know, or 70, which has a lot more value. And maybe, you know, we can look at putting a real good value on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. It obviously depends on the other team's projection of how the Ravens are going to finish the season. That's why maybe the Owe trade's interesting, because it's not a, they're not buying, they're not really selling. They're kind of halfway in, halfway out. Let's see how it all shakes out. So if, from that perspective, I think it was a smart move that a player that was underperforming, and it's hard to find a player that's improved upon last year on this whole roster, but Owe probably regressed more than anybody. So I understand it from that perspective for sure. But anyway, I know there's a lot of content out there about the Owe trade. I don't think you were getting a high round comp pick back. I think based off how he started the season, at least he was looking to more of a prove it deal next year.
Oh, I don't agree with that. Now, his pressure rate's been consistently high throughout his career. He took actually a step back. Okay, we got to talk about it a little bit since it's been brought up. But 23, he had a really good pressure season for pressure rate, okay? But he wasn't really converting a high percentage of his pressures into either quarterback hits or sacks. Quarterback hits or sacks over total pressures is what I call close rate, okay? Mm-hmm. I'll take either. I'll take anytime you knock the quarterback on the ground, though, very positive thing, even if it doesn't end up costing the other team 10 yards, I like when you knock the other quarterback onto the ground for what it does for your chance to win the game. So what happened in 2024 is he had 10 sacks, but his pressure rate was way down and his close rate was way up, almost 50% last year. So his pressure rate this year actually has not been terrible at all. It's right in line with where it's been typically throughout his career, which has always been pretty good. He doesn't have any closes at all so far. Yes, that's not true. He has some quarterback hits, but he doesn't have any sacks so far. People get very sack focused, and I actually think with the huge amount of money being spent on edge rushers, that we could have seen a contract that no one would believe for Owe, and we will probably get that chance to see exactly what he signs for. But my guess would be he'd be a $18-20 million a year guy.
Okay, well, time will tell. We'll see how he fares in Los Angeles. You know, that's the Ravens are kind of opening up. They're opening themselves up for some critique there. If he goes to LA and starts putting up numbers, then the heat is just going to continue to ratchet up on Zach Gore and John Harbaugh. Let's close with some philosophical mailbag questions from Eric Clark. And he starts with, do you believe that BPA is the most important when you have a top three QB. I know Voss has been the president of premium positions. Example, Starks over Simmons. Starks might have been the consensus better player, but Simmons was a more premium position.
Which Simmons is he talking about? Are you talking Josh Simmons, the left tackle?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So, yes, I agree with that. I think also he's slightly misrepresenting your point of view, but let me see if I can bend that back, bend the wire backwards. I think you've really moderated to premium skill set as yes. opposed to premium position. So yes. Starks being a free safety has more value. Now, there is some question over whether Starks has really demonstrated the free safety skills the Ravens would have liked him so far.
Yes. I remember doing a pre-draft show with you and writing down on my legal pad with a wish list, and Simmons was number one and Starks was number two. So I definitely thought they would have been good picks. The Ravens had already signed Ronnie Stanley at that point. So they said, we have a needed safety to have our third safety. And that's why they went with Starks, I think.
I know nobody wants to hear this right now, but Emin Wari just had his first real game for the Seahawks. He played 39 snaps and he looked like Kyle Hamilton. The guy, yeah. I mean, you look at the video, he looks like Kyle Hamilton. Look at the PFF scoring, he looks like Kyle Hamilton. Look at his ability to make tackles. I mean, this guy looks unbelievably good. And, you know, he certainly has, he was the Bo Jackson of safeties in terms of what he brought to the position. There's never been anybody like him in terms of size and speed at the position. He's just incredibly raw, but the first look is awfully, awfully good. And McDonald seems to have a good one.
Yeah, you know, you could even say he's the Odafe Oweh of safeties in some ways.
if you want to twist it the other way, you could.
Another one from Eric Clark here. Isn't it a perfect example? It isn't a perfect example, but let's use Likely and Jones. They are great players in our eyes, but are they worth $31 to $40 million combined as opposed to, say, paying Trey Hendrickson, the only realistic free agent edge? I believe you had another question in between that I lost here on my phone, but basically saying, should the Ravens build a top heavy roster? Paraphrasing there.
All right. So if he's saying I could have two players or I could have one, my preference would be in that situation would be to make sure that Travis Jones is the first guy back in the building. He drives the Ravens pass rush. And anytime he's out, you see it, but you have to have that guy who forces double teams in the middle. They're incredibly hard to find in the draft. The Ravens were very lucky to get him when they did. And he had a kind of a disappointing career at Connecticut in some ways, in terms of being a little bit sloppy on the field. Other guys like Christian Barmore and whatnot, they go much higher in the draft than Jones did. It give you that same kind of value on the interior of your defensive line and force absolutely command double teams.
Yeah, definitely was a steal to fall to the Ravens to that point. I do believe that especially when you have a high-priced quarterback, top-heavy roster construction is probably the best way. When you're a team like the Ravens that has a tremendous track record of developing UDFAs and has more day three picks than anybody else, that also lends that to that notion. The issue I might have with the construction is the top-heavy players might not play the right positions. They might play the more replaceable positions, whether it's running back or linebacker. I subscribe to the Daniel Jeremiah theory of roster building, where you need a quarterback, 2 to 3 above-average blockers, 2 to 3 offensive playmakers, a couple pass rushers, and a couple playmakers in the secondary. That's really your core. That's your foundation. And I would you know, move mountains to establish that foundation. And once you have that foundation in place, you can rotate the other more replaceable positions in and out on a year-to-year basis, as the Rams have done, which is, I think, what Eric was trying to get at there.
Okay. Legitimate point, certainly. Let's go to this one last question from Roger Crawford, who says, Ken, I was listening to 105.7, and Vinny said, if things go bad this week, Harbaugh may not have a choice on staff changes. I assume they're talking about the ownership direction. What if Harbaugh says no, he doesn't want to make the moves? Could he get pushed out, or ownership wouldn't make that demand and have their hand forced? Roger, it's a really legitimate question, and you're correct on where the silo is. For example, Eric DaCosta, I don't think, can pressure John Harbaugh to do it because he doesn't report to him. In fact, it might put a strain on their relationship for him to say, you got to get rid of Zach Orr. Now, on the other hand, if they're talking over their back fence, you know, they live right next door to each other, would it be something that he could say, you know, I've been in contact with Steve. He's very unhappy with the situation. He doesn't feel like he's communicated it fully to you. He asked that I do so. I don't want to, you know, overstep the bounds of our relationship or, you know, what our employment responsibilities are. But, you know, this might be a really good time to think about getting rid of Zach Gore because I'm afraid, you know, of what might happen if you don't.
We've heard rumors that that's been happened in the past and can neither confirm nor deny, but apparently there was some type of ownership pressure with Cam Cameron potentially. Real quick aside, you ever remember the show Tool Time? We were a long time ago. So which is it, DaCosta or Harbaugh, that's face is covered with the fence when they're having his backyard chats?
Yeah. Wilson is next door neighbor.
Yeah. Wilson. Like that was it. That was it. Yeah. I think Harbaugh should get the opportunity to sink or swim. And I think that he's coaching for his legacy. I think he's, you know, when Brian Billick was, you know, 2005, they had the one seed. I'm sorry, 2006, they had the one seed, and then it really turned around quick, and all of a sudden, he lost the locker room in 2007, and he was gone. And if you would have said in the middle of the 2006 season, what's your opinion of Billick, it would have been much higher. But now you look back, and history has not been quite as kind. And I think that if Harbaugh can turn this around and get the guys play, that was always the hallmark of Harbaugh teams. No matter what, Ryan Mallett, whoever it was, they always played hard. We haven't seen that fight the last couple games necessarily. If you can get them to that level, get your way into the playoffs, get a notch a playoff win or two, then, wow, what a coaching job. If it really goes south on him, you might be able to look back and nitpick his regular season record and nitpick his postseason record. So I do think that Harbaugh might not be coaching for his job, but I think he's coaching for his legacy in a lot of fans' eyes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I think there is, he's at risk, but he has signed, this was the last year of his previous deal sort of, and he got an extension for 3 years through 28. The normal time that he would be up for evaluation again and be lost would be at the end of 27 with 1 year left on the contract, because he would potentially go to Bisciotti and say, hey, how about we re-up a contract? I don't like coaching on a one-year deal, and you don't want me coaching on a one-year deal. And they might extend for 3 years, or they might just agree to part ways at that point, or they might say, look, John, we're not extending you. We'd like you to take, you know, 40% of your money and walk right now so we can get a new coach. So they'd have multiple ways to try and do it, but I think that would be the normal time. Now, given what's going on, I don't know what normal is anymore. I have no idea. I think at the end of this year, it's about a $40 million hit to Bisciotti personally, because this is off cap, off book.
$17 million a year. He's the third highest paid at $17 million a year I saw recently. You know, I can throw some stats out there that won't shine the brightest light on John Harbaugh, but I think he deserves the opportunity to see how it plays out. If you look back though, 5 years from now and doesn't work out, and you say, wow, they really missed the opportunity with the Lamar Jackson window. They held on to Roman too long. He, you know, gets all this credit for putting Mike McDonald in Michigan for an internship, but then he turns around and hires a neophyte play caller in Zach Gore. And it can be shaded in different ways. So he's really fighting for that, I think, from this down the stretch of season. And it's unfortunate that the season went this way. Nobody wanted it to happen. So let's see what kind of heart they show down the stretch.
Yeah, so he has legacy that will still be around in several ways. For starters, he's been around during this time, and it's been a generally successful time with Jackson and Harbaugh together as the largest components of the 2018 to 25 Ravens. I don't think he'll have a problem with that. I mean, he has a tremendous legacy in terms of what he was able to accomplish with Joe Flacco and not a whole lot else, including like the playoff appearance in 2014, the playoff appearance coming back in 18, you know, with Lamar in there. And then those first 5 years were just terrific. And he happened to win the Super Bowl with the worst of those teams.
You know, his playoff record since the Super Bowl has not been great. I was surprised about this though, Ken. Did you know that currently John Harbaugh has the 10th best career winning percentage among active coaches? I would have thought it was much higher, but currently as of today, he's the 10th highest career. Yeah. I thought it was
this. There's a lot of 400 hitters in April. Uh-huh. So how many of those guys like McDonald are working off, you know, 11-8 or something, and they're a shade ahead of Harbaugh.
The one is the Jacksonville guy, but the other guys are all pretty established.
Okay.
I looked at it's Nick Sirianni, 82 games, seven. His brother is at 67%. LaFleur, 112 games. McDermott, 150 games. Andy Reid, 470 games. Kevin O'Connell in Minnesota, 58. Tomlin, Sean Payton, and then John Harbaugh. John Harbaugh is slightly ahead of Sean McVay. But he's, I don't think that's good, but that's not great. And we've been kind of operating on the illusion, not the illusion, but the expectation that he's been great. And I think he's been more good. So this, if he gets that second Super Bowl with Lamar, then he's established great. If he doesn't, he leaves a little legacy on the table there.
All right. Well, that's not an unfair way to state it. I kind of hate the discussion because it's a little bit like the number one receiver discussion to me. It's you're actually trying to do what I would ask other people to do. It's like, write down for me now, who are the number one receivers in the league right now? And then I can tell you if the Ravens have one of them or not. Not by your, you know, your definition is probably going to be intentionally exclusive to the Ravens wide receivers if you're complaining about the wide receiver role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, fair enough. Voss, always a pleasure doing this show with you. Tell folks where they can contact you online if they have a football question, and also a brief recap of where your restaurant is.
Yeah, sure. I am at Vasilis Fiammata on Twitter, X, VASILISFIAMATA. Fiammata is the name of our Italian restaurant and lounge. We opened in March, and we ask you to please consider us for any of your private events, birthday parties, any of that sort of thing. We have private rooms. We're very customizable with the menus and the offerings. We're located in Finksburg, Maryland.
Have you done anything with the extra space you had? We got the tour one of the initial weeks. Have you set up a
private room? That's phase two, but we do have the second dining room is essentially a private room that could accommodate up to 60. We just had a big event there yesterday, so we can make it private, print special menus for you, whatever you like.
All right, very cool. Other folks out there, thanks for listening as always. Hopefully you'll tune in on this show no matter what happens with the Ravens, whether or not you're into the matchup shows or the offensive and defensive reviews and whatnot. But this is a show you definitely want to stay plugged into throughout the offseason, all the way until the Ravens are, until the draft and then beyond. But thanks for listening. Keep your questions coming to hashtag Film Study Mailbag. Voss, for Voss Loricus, this is Ken McKusick saying goodbye. We'll talk to you next week on Film Study.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com. That's policygenius.com.